Today is Friday, October 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, despite a White House-brokered ceasefire in Syria, reports of skirmishes remain.
That despite the announcement of the ceasefire, it's called different things, pauses by others, shelling and intermittent clashes continue.
Also ahead, has the White House made it more difficult to defend its Ukraine call? And what's next for Hong Kong after a very dramatic week? Those stories and more are all coming up next. Fighting continues in the Kurdish-held Syrian towns. Despite Thursday's ceasefire announcement, the AP's Charles Desma starts us off.
Shelling and gunfire could be heard in and around Ras el Ain as smoke billowed from locations near the border with Turkey and the Kurdish town of Ceylan Pınar. The fighting had died down by mid-morning while smoke continued to rise. Elsewhere along the border, calm seemed to prevail with no fighting heard along the border west from Ras el Ain. Turkey and the US have agreed a five-day ceasefire which requires the Kurdish fighters to vacate a swathe of territory along the Kurdish border. That arrangement would largely solidify the position Turkey has gained after days of fighting. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan countered reports saying that there was no ongoing clashes in northeastern Syria, while French President Emmanuel Macron says Turkey's military operation in Syria is madness. U.S. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper says that U.S. troops will not be on the ground to monitor the ceasefire. And as VOA continues to monitor and follow the story, you'll be able to find updates on our website, voanews.com. Now, to take a closer look at how recent events will further shape the region, I spoke earlier with Craig Albert, professor at Augusta University.
I don't think it was much of a deal. It looks like that the United States handed a strategic victory over to Turkey. Turkey signals that it doesn't really view this as a ceasefire because it doesn't view its opposition as a legitimate actor. So it says it will continue all operations against any supposed terrorist threat. And they view the Kurds in that area as a terrorist threat. So this is how they are continuing to legitimize their violence in Syria, is by saying it's not, the ceasefire only holds to a legitimate actor. So they're playing both hands right now. They're trying to appease the United States while also continuing operations against what it claims are terrorists.
So where do things go from here? Because the vice president said very, definitively at the ambassador's residence, he was there to stop the fighting.
It's complicated to say where it's going from here. We have the Russians, Vladimir Putin, saying that it needs to stop, that his main objective is to make sure that Syria and Turkish forces don't clash. That's the worst-case situation that we could be heading to, is to see the Syrian military and the Turkish military clash on Syrian ground. So that's what all sides want to prevent. So everybody's trying to broker a legitimate ceasefire that does not allow that to occur. But the ceasefire that we have right now, why that's not really a good ceasefire for all parties involved is that, first of all, the Kurdish forces weren't involved in the negotiation, so they really have no reason to obey by it, even though there are reports that they told the United States, they have representatives to the United States, they said that they would obey by the ceasefire. There's really no legitimate reason for them to do so since they weren't included in the talks. The whole point of this incursion by Turkey is to push all Kurds out of this area of an exclusion zone that's about 20 miles deep and anywhere between 270 and 300 miles in width. So that's a lot of Kurdish territory that the Turkish military and Syria militias that are aligned with the Turkish military are trying to take. So there's not really legitimate aims for the Kurds to obey by this, and the same for the Turkish military as well. If they view the Kurds as terrorists in this, why would they agree to a ceasefire?
What does this do long term to the reputation and U.S. foreign policy stance, given that there are many who view this deal as inadequate?
I think objectively, this is the first real serious blow to President Trump's foreign policy agenda, where he says he will continue to back the United States' allies, and especially NATO. This is something that the world has been wondering how strong of a commitment they would see from President Trump. With now we get to see that maybe the United States' strategic obligations aren't that sound. The Kurds have been a strategic ally for a couple of decades, especially outside of Iraq, or inside of Iraq now, and then moving to the fight against ISIS in Syria, they've been very staunch allies of the United States for the past 5 years. And so by not supporting the Kurds and by allowing all their advances to be taken back, all the territory to be taken back that they fought against ISIS, this shows that we don't hold credible commitments to the Kurds. This might signal to NATO allies that the United States can no longer be a trusted ally. This is terrifying for the potentiality of something happening with Russia. Perhaps Russia moves further into Ukraine or does something strategic in the Baltics region. This concerns everybody with NATO that the United States can't be trusted.
Craig Albert is a professor at Augusta University in Georgia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney acknowledged to reporters at the White House that the U.S. President Donald Trump held back military aid for Ukraine earlier this year, in part to pressure Kiev to look into allegations about the 2016 U.S. presidential election.
I was involved with the process by which the money was held up temporarily. Okay, three issues for that: the corruption in the country, whether or not other countries were participating in the support of the Ukraine, and whether or not they were cooperating in an ongoing investigation with our Department of Justice.
To be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happened as well.
We do that all the time with foreign policy. We were holding up money at the same time for, what was it, the Northern Triangle countries.
Mulvaney went on to say that the halt in funding had nothing to do with Vice President Joe Biden. Mulvaney also announced that next year's G7 summit would be held at the President's Doral Resort in Florida, immediately bringing up concerns of self-dealing and possible violations of the U.S. Constitution's Emoluments Clause. The acting chief of staff said the summit would be held at cost so the president wouldn't be benefiting from it. Joining us on the phone to break things down is Joel Paul, professor at the University of California Hastings Law School. Joel, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So what is your take on Mulvaney's statements? I mean, let's start with the Ukraine one first. Did that create problems? And is his statement in line with proper use of funds and U.S. public policy when speaking to other leaders?
Well, clearly the answer to that is no. Regardless of whether or not there was an explicit quid pro quo, which Mulvaney has clearly admitted there is one, but even if there had not been an explicit quid pro quo, the president has no authority to withhold funds that have been appropriated by Congress to aid an ally. Even Mulvaney said that would be illegal later in his press conference. Secondly, the president can't solicit help in his campaign from a foreign leader. So even if he didn't make it an explicit quid pro quo, he did, and the president acknowledges this, and we know the transcript, that the president did ask the leader of Ukraine to help him go after the Bidens and go after the Democrats. Mulvaney's point, I think, is a distinction without a difference. He's trying to say that they didn't ask for help going after Biden in the investigation, but rather for help going after the Democrats, alleging that the 2016 allegations about Russian involvement in the election was a setup, and that Ukraine was really the one that had set this up from the beginning. One has to question, why is it the president is so deeply invested in trying to clear Russia's name? Why is the president interested in trying to show that, contrary to the reports of all of the intelligence community, that Russia had no responsibility for the interference in the 2016 election?
In the time we have left, we have about a minute left. I want to get your take on the emoluments question regarding the G7 going to Doral. Is it, in fact, no conflict if the resort takes the G7 summit at cost?
Well, there's no such thing in business. Mr. Trump apparently has borrowed $100 million or more from the Deutsche Bank to finance his purchase of Doral. He owes money to Deutsche Bank. The the G7 meeting in June is at a time when resorts in Florida, of course, are largely vacant because of the weather conditions. He's going to fill the hotel with people who are going to pay whatever he decides is the cost of their rooms. That clearly is going to help him refinance his debt. So it's not a distinction that matters here.
Okay.
The fact is that both of these stories, there's a common theme to both of the stories, and that is that Mr. Trump seems to have difficulty distinguishing between his self-interest and his duties as president of the United States.
Joel Paul, as a professor at the University of California Hastings Law School, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This was only just part of a very fast-moving week in the news in and around the White House and the impeachment inquiry. Joining us also on the phone is Catherine Gibson, VOA's congressional correspondent, and she is joining us from Capitol Hill. Catherine?
Hello.
So, really briefly, can you take us through what we learned this week during the impeachment inquiry hearings?
Absolutely, Steve. This has been an absolutely key week up here on Capitol Hill in terms of that impeachment inquiry. It's when all of the pieces really started to fall into place following that whistleblower allegation that came out a couple of weeks ago and launched the House Democrats' formal impeachment inquiry. We had key testimony from a number of former Trump administration officials that really added up to a clearer picture showing that President Trump was deeply involved in this effort to influence U.S. policy in Ukraine to benefit his personal political interests. Now, the House has a long way to go in building that case and in getting to drafting articles of impeachment, but we certainly understood a lot more at the end of this week thanks to that testimony.
Now, we also saw that Representative Elijah Cummings passed away, and he was the chair of the House Oversight Committee, one of the three committees that is investigating and conducting these impeachment inquiry hearings. How is that process moving forward?
Right. I mean, that was really just stunning news Thursday morning, Steve, when someone who is deeply, deeply respected up here on Capitol Hill by lawmakers really on both sides of the aisle. Cummings had good friends among Republicans, Mark Meadows. He received tributes from Trey Gowdy. It was just a terrible day here. Many lawmakers crying in the hallways and really surprised because he had been one of the leaders in the impeachment inquiry, heading that powerful oversight committee. Now, in recent weeks, he had largely ceded that to Adam Schiff, who is the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, because he had been in such ill health. A lot of people up here are saying that this is a huge loss, not just for the country, but also in political terms for that impeachment inquiry, because he was such a respected voice, because he had that passion for justice. He really could have been an outspoken person in terms of leading this inquiry.
Now, we're going into the weekend now, but the impeachment inquiry is not showing any signs of letting up. What's next for these three committees?
Right. So we have another full schedule next week when the House comes back into session on Monday. We have a number of officials from the State Department, from the Foreign Service Office, from the Office of Management and Budget, from the Pentagon. And these are all agencies that the House Intelligence Committee is seeking documents from to build their case, to get the paper record, the paper trail, in those terms, from these different agencies to show the pattern of how all of this unfolded within the government agencies. So far, they've had some subpoenas go out that have not been effective, but we'll have to see how those depositions play out behind closed doors.
Now, there were also some deadlines approaching as far as when certain offices were supposed to release documents.
Right, yeah, and so House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's decision earlier this week not to hold a formal floor vote launching the impeachment inquiry was an interesting one, because we know that that's what President Trump is saying is the reason why he can't comply with these subpoenas. He's saying that because there's no actual legal formal launch to this inquiry, he doesn't have to comply with it. Now, Speaker Pelosi came out and said that the House is fully within its constitutional rights to conduct this impeachment inquiry, and no formal floor vote is needed. They're going to have to go to court to enforce those subpoenas now.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory reports its heat flow and physical properties package, one of three primary instruments on its Mars InSight lander, is moving again. Nicknamed the Mole, the heat probe is supposed to burrow itself into the surface of Mars to take its internal temperature. The Mole was designed to dig as much as 16 meters into the interior of Mars, but in early March 2019, after digging to a depth of about 35 centimeters, it hit rocks and stopped working. To get the Mole moving again, operators of the InSight lander used its robotic arm to help it dig nearly 2 centimeters over the past week. NASA says while the current digging process is modest, renewed movement of the probe is significant. The space agency's InSight lander was sent to explore the interior structure of the Red Planet. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. In Hong Kong, protests continue today with many anti-government demonstrators wearing face masks despite a police ban on them. Protesters have choked sections of the city since June. Originally, they demanded the government drop plans to pass a law allowing criminal suspects to be sent to mainland China. While that legislation has been abandoned, the protesters have other demands, including the resignation of the city's leader, Carrie Lam, and an investigation of what they consider police abuses. VOA correspondent Anita Powell is in the semi-autonomous Chinese city and gave International Edition managing editor Kate Pound Dawson an update.
So it's Friday night in Hong Kong, and across the city we have people forming human chains to again express their dissatisfaction with the leadership of Hong Kong and with the Chinese government. But largely today it's been an outburst of protests around the city, but they've been peaceful. They've been quite overwhelmingly large. Earlier today, I was in one in near Chartered Gardens in the central part of the city in the financial district, and there were at least 1,000 people who just out of nowhere appeared and marched down the street and shouted the very familiar refrain of five demands, not one less. So it's clear that there's still fuel behind this movement. But it remains to be seen this weekend what direction that's going to take.
Now, the police did say that they are not allowing, they will not give a permit for the demonstration that was planned on Sunday. Is it going to go ahead?
I spoke to a Hong Kong legislator this evening who told me that, yes, the plan is for it to go ahead. And I've seen no indication that it won't go ahead. Of course, it is more than 24 hours from now, so a lot of that could change. But at this point, the protesters said to me, many protesters said to me on the street today, they're not giving up, they're not daunted, they're not afraid, and they're going to keep going until they get what they want, which is the five demands.
Also, on the political front, it sounds like Chief Executive Carrie Lam had a bit of a rough week. What was going on?
That might be putting it mildly to say that Carrie Lam had a rough week. She was shouted out of the Legislative Council chambers, not once, but twice, on Wednesday and on Thursday when she attempted to address lawmakers. She was forced, as she says, to give her policy address remotely via a pre-recorded speech. But what's really remarkable to note is that even in the face of this very clear sign of disapproval, she is refusing to back down in the face of these five demands. She did a Facebook Live yesterday with one of her colleagues, and she kind of brushed off one of the newest demands, because there are actually five demands plus one more. And the plus one more is a reorganization of the police force. And she kind of smirked and said, I don't see why that makes sense to anybody. We need the police to provide public safety. You know, if you fall down and break your leg, or if you get robbed, who are you going to call if we disband the police? She's holding firm, and she's flexing her muscles. And I think that's notable.
That was VOA's Anita Powell speaking to our own Kate Pound Dawson from Hong Kong. Nationwide protests paralyzed Lebanon on Friday as thousands of demonstrators blocked major roads in a second day of rallies against the government's handling of a severe economic crisis and the country's political class they perceive as being corrupt. The protests are the largest Lebanon has seen since 2015 and could further destabilize the country. Provincial officials said an explosion rocked a mosque in eastern Afghanistan as dozens of people gathered to offer Friday prayers, causing the roof to collapse and killing 62 worshipers. 36 were others. Were wounded. It was not immediately clear if the mosque was attacked by a suicide bomber, according to authorities. An intense gunfight with heavy weapons and burning vehicles blocking roads paralyzed the capital of Mexico's Sinaloa state after security forces captured the son of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, who is wanted in the United States on drug trafficking charges. Suspected cartel gunmen counterattacked the security forces with large weapons, forcing them to free Ovidio Guzman Lopez. Authorities say at least 8 people died in the battle. U.S. astronauts Christina Koch and Jessica Meir made history on Friday when they stepped outside the International Space Station for the first all-female spacewalk. The much-anticipated milestone for NASA was achieved during a relatively routine mission to swap faulty batteries on the station's exterior. A new report says harmful algal blooms on lakes have been increasing over the past 3 decades, largely due to warming from climate change, fertilizer runoff, and poor water management. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the study's co-author, Anna McCulloch, a climate scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford University.
Whenever you go to a pond or a lake, if you see that the water is greenish in color, that's because there's phytoplankton in the water. And when you get either too much of that phytoplankton or certain types of phytoplankton that create toxins, then you have what we call harmful algal blooms. And that's what people are mostly concerned about. You may remember that in 2014, the city of Toledo had to shut down its entire water supply because of the level of toxins in its drinking water. And that was the result of a harmful algal bloom in Lake Erie.
How do these intense algal blooms in lakes end up hurting people?
They get eaten by zooplankton, which are very, very tiny animals, which themselves might get eaten, for example, by fish, and then the fish could get eaten by human beings or other animals.
So phytoplankton is a bad thing?
Phytoplankton in of itself is not in any way a bad thing. In fact, it's absolutely necessary for the survival of ecosystems. It's simply when those ecosystems get thrown off their natural balance that we can start to see problems.
These blooms on lakes have been occurring for some time. Why hasn't there been a systematic scientific study of these blooms before yours?
The trouble with studying lakes is that very few lakes around the world have long-standing monitoring programs. And so this was the first study that was able to look in a consistent way at dozens of lakes across 6 continents. So over 2/3 of the lakes that we looked at have been experiencing blooms that are more intense in recent years than they were before. In some cases, it tracked with warming water. In other cases, it tracked with increasing precipitation, rainfall. In other cases, it tracked with more intense fertilizer use.
Why can fertilizer use pose a danger?
When farmers apply fertilizer to their land, if some of that fertilizer runs off with water and ends up in streams that end up in lakes, then you're essentially feeding those nutrients to the lake. And that's part of what feeds these phytoplankton blooms. Conversely, if in the lake you have blooms of toxin-producing phytoplankton, then applying that water to the fields can then transfer those toxins to the crops that are growing in those same fields. So the impact can go in both directions.
What can be done to slow down or even stop all these toxic phytoplankton blooms in the lakes?
There are some things that need to be done on a global scale. If we're going to limit the warming of lakes, that's something that we need to take on an international scale. But the specific reasons why a particular lake is changing in a given direction is very lake specific. So we can better manage, for example, nutrient inputs into those lakes and also plan for water uses from those lakes, whether it be for agriculture or for drinking water or other uses altogether, so that you know what issues you might have to deal with in making use of that water.
Anna McCulloch is a climate scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford University. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that's going to do it for us. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha, Nick Ivanoff, our engineer, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great weekend.